second part of talk given on Tuesday morning, 29th May 1973. It is important to have as clear an understanding of what is meant by liberation, the realization of Atma or Brahman, or freedom, or perfection, and so on. Let us look at what happens to the individual living the religious life in his ascent, if I may use that word, towards the final consummation. Purification we have talked of. Certain disciplinary procedures, bodily and mental, we have talked of. Now, the heart of the matter is this. Our imperfection lies in the fact that the mind has not come to maturity . Practically no one's mind ever comes to maturity. The millions of people who are born, they live, they die with the mind immature, imperfect, unclean. Millions of bodies come to maturity. They may be reasonably healthy throughout life, suffer illnesses also. But in certain senses, the body always does come to maturity with the passage of time. We go through babyhood, childhood, puberty, adolescence, and then in the 20s, and by 30, practically everyone's body is a mature body, as far as that body will be a mature body. But with the mind, no. So there is this perpetual ill state in the individual. The immature mind and the body being not in harmony, therefore, with the mind. The whole of the religious life has as its major aspect this bringing the mind to fruition. Nature brings the body to maturity. It is oneself who of his own free will and accord has to bring the mind to maturity and fruition. Nature won't do it. Why? Because nature, having made the body with this extraordinary potentiality latent within this creature called man, has to stop short, because this creature called man has to become awake to his withinness, and then use that withinness deliberately in order to carry on the further task of bringing the mind to maturity. This is a very important point, not sufficiently understood. Now, the body is the most concrete expression, the solid state is the most concrete expression of the one total reality. The mind is, just to use the commoner garden word, the immaterial expression of the one total reality. Now, mind is universal just as matter is universal. The millions of bodies and objects in the universe derive from the one universal matter. And do remember that in the scientific sense, matter and energy are quite interchangeable terms. Now, what is there in each one of us as a body? What is there which expresses mind, this universal thing called mind, distinctively? This is psyche. This energy which is immeasurable and unknown by me, which is termed mind, which deals unto me, an energy which on its own plane I can't control, like I can control physical energies like electricity or heat, etc. That universal energy meeting the particular body, not that it comes and meets, but you know what I mean, acting upon the particular body, gives rise to what we call psyche, whose roots are the actual physical brain and nerves and ductless glands and the blood and so forth. So that this universal characterless, formless, shapeless energy gets structured and manifests in different ways, in different people. So you see, we say, my mind is different from his mind, and so forth. But remember that just as the body is matter which is patterned, specifically patterned, distinctively patterned, out of the universal matter, you see, so too psyche is the distinctively patterned representative of the universal thing, which is mind. Now, mind, so we can call psyche, we'll use the terms interchangeably, mind and psyche. Mind in me is brought to maturity through my own understanding and the way I utilize my life energies. And in bringing it to maturity, it is in complete alignment, complete harmony with universal mind. Those of you who have deeply entered Buddhism particularly will see the significance of that. Now, how does mind generally manifest in us? As our particular thoughts, our ideas, our knowledge, our memories, our preconceptions, assumptions, biases, prejudices, and all the rest of it. This universal free thing is made unfree, it is constricted and restricted in these terms. And the body-mind organism, which is one's own self, manifests all this in the world. And because it is in an immature state, it is in a confused state, a state full of inward conflict and disharmony, there is what we call the suffering, the evil, the dukkha in the world, in ourselves and in the world, therefore.
our world.
You will see then that the task of bringing the mind to maturity consists essentially in freeing the mind from the limitations imposed upon it by the particular thoughts, convictions, beliefs, doctrines, dogmas, etc., that we have. Because as we tried to see yesterday, every one of these beliefs, doctrines, dogmas, is not understood by any one of us in the same way as it is understood by everyone else. Each one has his own different mental form and mental content of the words which express an idea, a belief, a doctrine, a conviction, or whatever it is. And that difference is due to our particular conditioning, which is tied up with our own body, our bodily life, our upbringing, our particular circumstances, our social and cultural heritage, and all the rest of it. It's an extraordinarily complex story. And its being complex is not the trouble. The more perfect a manifestation is, the greater is its complexity. But all the complex parts are beautifully interrelated, and they interact in perfection, in harmony, like an orchestra playing. You see? When this complexity is changed into complication, then the dis-ease has set in. See? When, for example, in our own bodies, what the doctor calls a complication arises, there is an ill patient who needs healing. Isn't that so? It is the complication, not the complexity. Take the body itself. It's an extraordinarily complex organism. But so long as everything works in harmony, rightly, the relationships are there, nothing is disturbed, then that complex body, its very complexity is the marvel of it and the wonder of it. Now, similarly with the mind, our minds are not only complex, but they are complicated, tangled up. The Buddha uses that term, this tangled web. Now, the tangling is due to the influence of the actual assumptions, preconceptions, prejudices, beliefs, thoughts, ideas, and so forth, with which our mind is cluttered up all the time. It also includes what we call our learning. What we learn has a dual aspect and a dual effect upon us. Part of it enables us to have a valuable tool for the process of living. Obviously, skills and know-hows have to be present for the ordinary everyday process of living. But these skills and know-hows and this learning has a tendency, in fact not a tendency, it always does it, to produce a fixation in the mind. I have learned this, I state it verbally, it means precisely that to me when I state it like that, and I let it remain fixed. Now this fixation is the constipation of the mind. Hence the dis-ease of the mind. So the main task in bringing the mind to maturity is to be attentive in that manner which reveals to us all the time the fixed state of the mind, the unelastic state. And you know, when an organism has become unelastic, well, it's dying or dead. It has become a corpse. So, the whole process of religious study, which is the minor aspect of it, and meditation and mindfulness, which are the major aspects of it, is directed towards the release of our minds from all this constipating stuff. Now note carefully, this doesn't mean that we just have to throw out of the window all our beliefs, conceptions, ideas and so forth. Try it. I have tried it. You can't, at least I couldn't do it. Because the functioning of the mind, of the living mind, is constantly producing new thoughts and ideas and so forth. With every observation that takes place, with every stimulus that comes and affects the mind. You can never be free of that. So, wherein does the release come? The release comes through seeing the ways in which the ideas, the reactions become fixations and limit you from keeping the mind open, being awake. It's very significant. The Buddha called himself the fully self-awakened one. The fully awakened one. And he spoke of himself as one not liable to delusion. See, the fixations of the mind are one of the primary factors responsible for all sorts of illusions and delusions. This is where creeds have played such havoc. Creeds from which there must be no deviation. This is the final and absolute truth. Now the mistake lies in calling it the final truth. There is no such thing as finality in a living universe. Living, to be living, means to change, to grow. And growth, the cycle of growth, ordinarily involves the coming to birth, the maturing, then the gradual decaying, aging, and dying. And the dying, remember, really is a transforming. Nothing is dead in the sense of completely annihilated or lost. Now, with the mind, it is different. The mind can come to maturity and become stronger and stronger right to the end of the body. It becomes purer, it becomes more efficient, more effective, more lucid, more transparent, more free of all the clutter of fixations. So, this process of meditation and the entry into the deep states, as we say, means essentially that the mind is becoming free of all this which obstructs its true nature, its mature state, and its ever-growing, ever-advancing state. We have talked a few days ago, we have talked about the significance of posture, the symbolic significance of it. The base of the spine, the root, points earthwards to the center of the earth. But this points to the zenith, and the zenith is immeasurable, nowhere, whereas the center of the earth is a fixed point. This represents fixation. That represents the absolute freedom. So in that absolute freedom, everything can happen, everything can go on, there is no end to it at all. There is no final truth about anything. And in fact, the whole process of thought formation, specific limited thought formation, and its verbal expression ceases in the supreme states of consciousness. Now we can understand the meaning of the word Atma, or of Brahman, or of the spirit in man, and so forth. The Varaha Upanishad puts it in as perfect a form as I have seen in any of the old scriptures. That which is consciousness alone, which is all-pervading, eternal, which is all full of the form of bliss, and which is indestructible, is the only true Brahman. Just before that, the Upanishad identifies Atma with Brahman. Atma is the subjective term, Brahman is the objective term. That's all. That's the real difference. But note that the Atma or Brahman is not an entity. Note the terms which are used. That which is consciousness alone, which is all-pervading. What is the entity which is all-pervading? It's not an entity, obviously, because the very word entity means limitation, and therefore finitude, therefore birth, growth, dissolution. Again, which is eternal. It has transcended all the limits of time and space. That is to say, put it the other way around, time and space are conditionings of our own consciousness from which we do not escape unless and until we are able to enter into that supreme state. You see? And that is eternity, where measurability is non-existent altogether. And if measurability is totally non-existent, space and time as we know them and are conscious of them are absent. Therefore, in a sense, that implies the true void, the shunya, the emptiness as we call it. But this emptiness is no vacuity, which is all full. It is the plenitude. It is the great mystery of the container and the contained, which are an identity. That which is contained, the creative, active energy, by its own self-constriction, produces its own container. It becomes self-manifest. And that self-manifestation is the container, the containment of the contained. The two are entirely inseparable. Which is of the form of bliss. It's a strange way they have of saying, of the form of bliss. Yesterday we talked a bit about the meaning of the word form, you remember? Not merely the external shape, but the informing principle. Form is used in that sense, which they used right up till the Middle Ages. Then the word form began to be exclusively used for the outward shape and appearance, and which is indestructible, is the only true Brahman. Now, we have to beware. It is the intellect which is at work when we are talking about this and when we are reading it. And you know what the intellect does? Immediately projects it outwards and tries to make a limited shape of what the words might stand for, might symbolize. No. I'll give you another set of words. You yourself, utterly pure, utterly still and silent, the mind completely empty, transparent, lucid, the nexus for the free inflow and outflow of transcendent energy. That state is the meaning of the word Atma or Brahman. Now you see, that statement and the meaning understood that way has its roots essentially psychologically. But psychologically in the sense of the psychology of the utterly purified psyche. Not the psyche in conflict, not the immature, the diseased mind or psyche. This, I hope this presentation, which is my own presentation in the English language, perhaps has its value for our day and age. You meditate upon this statement, you brood upon it, let it deliver up its secret to you. And Brahman and Atma, or perfection and fulfillment and all these things, will have ceased to have a meaning external to you, a reality external to you. It will be your own reality. And thereby it will cease to be a goal towards which there is some sort of path which you have to move towards or move on and towards the goal in order to attain. It is you in your total living process. The here now is realized, and that realization of the here now, the realizing, I should say, is the meaning of immortality. Because it is beginningless, it is endless. And being beginningless and endless, there is no middle to it. There is no finitude to it at all. It is the non-finite actually being realized from moment to moment of your living process through the day. You yourself, utterly purified, still and silent. And remember that stillness and silence doesn't mean merely just sitting in this posture forever, because you can't. You see? It includes movement and sound. Still and silent. Empty. Lucid. Transparent. The nexus for the free, unimpeded inflow and outflow of transcendent energy itself. That state is the meaning of Atma or Brahman. So now, it is towards that state of wholeness, health, maturity, life abundant, eternal being, which includes within itself the total becoming. That is what the whole of the religious life is moving into. Then, of that state in which you yourself are, it can truly be said, God's in his heaven, all's well with the world. But before the realization of that state, which is the culminating point, there is the inward movement towards that state. And the primary characteristic of that inward movement is a process of complete denudation. Complete and total denudation of every fixed idea, thought, belief, etc., etc. Which means that the activity of the mind, of transcendent mind energy as such, within your own psychophysical being, becomes less and less hindered and obstructed by the present state of the psychophysical being, which is not the deified, the divinized, the perfect state, the holy state. See? So this complete denuding process takes place. Now the nature of this denuding process, where the mind is concerned, is different from denudation as it takes place physically, in nature and with one's own body. Denudation with nature is the wearing away of solid substance from the place where it is. For example, the denudation which takes place through the activity of glaciers, of rain, and all the rest of it. You see? And the wind. Denudation takes place. Actual matter is moved away. With the mind, it is not as if bits of the mind are moved away or thrown out. You can't throw anything out of the window where the mind is concerned. Understand this, and this absurd conflict between virtue and vice, fighting the good fight and all that rubbish will be out. And you'll use your energies, your psychical energies, your intellectual and moral capital in the right way. You'll invest it in the right way. And not in bogus companies. You see? Now, what happens is that that which is obstructive is rendered completely resilient. Ideas never have, when you do that and achieve it, ideas don't have any fixation at all. And therefore, any resistance to the free activity of the mind, the flowering process of the mind, they don't have any resistance. The mind becomes increasingly resilient, totally resilient, till the point comes when you see that ideas, beliefs, etc., and knowledge, as we say, which we have gathered, has no validity of its own. It's a perpetually passing stream. You are, so to say, now, of course, all analogies are difficult. They have their limitations. You're like the man on the river bank watching the river flowing past. Only in this case, the river doesn't flow in the mind. The river, the stream of thoughts and desires and everything doesn't flow past, but it undergoes transformation within the mind itself. That is its flowing. That is its cleansing. That is its purifying, and so forth. And that is the way the mind comes to maturity. Now, if this has been understood. Now we can understand what perhaps the Buddha meant when he spoke in these terms. When you meditate, you see with right wisdom. I prefer to put it this way, you see with unerring insight that every state of mind, every feeling, every idea as it emerges is not the ultimate real. It is in an ill state. You know, the anicca, anatta, dukkha, the three signs of being as they are called, the three characteristics. Then you see very clearly what he meant by saying, and so the bhikkhu puts it aside because he knows that it is impermanent. I prefer to use the word relative because impermanent has its dual, the permanent. But the relative does not have as its opposite dual the absolute. It doesn't. The relative contains the two duals within itself. Every feeling, thought, system of thought, state of consciousness is relative. Being relative, it is not the final fulfillment, the nirvana. Therefore, the bhikkhu, with unerring insight, seeing this, puts it aside, meaning he does not grasp at it. As clearer and clearer ideas emerge, as one's perceptions become finer and finer, you never grasp at a single idea or perfection for keeps. You see? You let it go. You let this stream of the becoming process flow, flow and flow, unhindered. Flow past. It becomes transformed in your own being. And in this is the great liberating process of the mind from all that causes it to be in a diseased condition. The condition of dukkha, ordinarily translated as suffering. But in reality, meaning the not infinite. That is, the not free, the not unconstrained. That is dukkha. Far from the infinite spoilt. In the Visuddhimagga you find this statement, the contemptible void. That is the Venerable Jnanamoli's translation. I haven't got the original Pali text of the Visuddhimagga. I'd like to see it and see if I could find a more helpful expression in the English language. But I think that to say that dukkha, the Pali dukkha, is the Sanskrit duh. And dhuh means made bad, spoilt. And kha is the infinite, the non-finite, spoilt. Which means it's constricted and thereby spoilt. That state of complete freedom, which is in consciousness itself, is no longer there. So now, the whole process, the meditation, the entry into the deep states, the jhanas, the samapatis and so forth, is all a way by which one is freed from this clutter. A denudation of the mind takes place. Now, It is perfectly natural to ask, but if the mind is denuded like this, you become mindless. And in fact, Upanishads like the Maitri Upanishad openly use the word, unto mindlessness you come. And that is the supreme state, they say. Well, of course, the man of the world quite naturally says, good heavens, I don't want to reach a state of gibbering vacuity. I want to be intelligent. That's what he would say. But what is the meaning of this mindlessness? That which we call mind actually consists of the diseased state of the mind, all the clutter in the mind. Is that mind? Mind, the transcendent creative energy, has no such clutter. So now, when this mindlessness is realized, what actually has happened? Here we understand the deep meaning of the word intelligence, the meaning in the religious context, the spiritual context. Intelligence is the power of the mind to see the truth of the thing as it is. Give concrete examples of the functioning of this intelligence. Again and again the Buddha says, and you find it in the New Testament with respect to Jesus, he knows with his mind, this is the language in which it is put, what was in the other person's mind, or his feelings, or his psychical state, and so forth. He knows with his mind, as he calls it. Now you see, this is the liberated intelligence perceiving without any sort of intermediary in between. Direct perception, directly knowing. And moreover, not only directly knowing with the knowing that is beyond thought and speech, but then translating it to step it down to our psychophysical level, presenting it with the appropriate thought and speech form. This is what comes about with the denudation of the mind. For the first time, you really are Lord of the mind. Until then, we are not quite so intelligent. In fact, a great many people are perpetually stupid. You see the implications then. Now realize quite clearly that in that state there is no separate self present. That is to say, the consciousness of a separate self does not intrude upon the awareness in terms of total reality. This is one of the extraordinary things about the really holy man. No wonder in India they use the phrase Aham Brahmasmi, or they use that other phrase, he who has realized, made real the Atma. And if you remember what I said, you yourself purified, still and silent, etc., etc., that state is the state to which the name Atma is given. You have realized, made real that state. Now, you the person, possessed, hemmed in ordinarily by isolative self-consciousness, in the process of this release, all isolativeness in your consciousness has disappeared. And it is the isolative self-consciousness which affirms I am I in the sense of I am I but not you. Now this is a fundamental error. You are another version of me at any and every stage of our existence. I am another version of you. You and I and all the yous and I's which exist in the world are part and parcel, integral parts and parcel, in fact, in transcendent fact, of the one total reality we call mankind. Let us restrict ourselves for the moment to mankind. It is large enough, there are 3,500 millions of us. But it actually extends to the entire universe, you see. But we are part and parcel of all mankind. Now it is this integrity of that, of being that part and parcel of the one whole, which is spoiled by the immature state of our mind, which deliberately abstracts the I as a separate I. Now you see, in deliberately separating I am I from you, we have laid the foundations of disharmony, of quarrel, of the unlove state, of the unwise condition, of the condition which is not good. Of the condition which is the denial of virtue, that transcendent power of totality. Of the condition which is the denial of beauty. That beauty which thrills at the heart of everything, provided it is not hemmed in. Nature has given us marvelous lessons of what beauty means in what she produces. And she has made our senses in such a way that through all our senses we can experience that loveliness, that beauty. Love, beauty, they always go together. Truth, wisdom, all these things go together. She has made our senses as the avenues through which that beauty and marvel and wonder of life can be ours perpetually. But we have hemmed in the free activity of our senses, because the serpent of desire, of passion for self, this unhappy trick by which we orient everything to ourself instead of letting ourself freely be part and parcel of the totality, the integral part and parcel. Part and parcel with integrity, truth, completeness, wholeness, that's what it means. So you see the significance and the implications of this living of the holy life, and the meaning of meditation, the meaning of prayer, the deep contemplative prayer, that the mystics of the world talk of, the theistic mystics. We use the term meditation in Hindu and Buddhist teachings, and so forth. This is what it is about. And when it happens, your state is one which is the form of bliss. Don't regard these words, or don't feel these words, as the carrot enticing the donkey to attain a bliss. It is not a bliss. This bliss is present in you, in that liberated state, whatsoever the circumstance and condition may be. And that circumstance and condition, by the very fact that it is a circumstance, a condition, has the duality of pain and pleasure involved in it, which you will never escape. It has the duality at the psychical, mental level of heaven and hell with it. But the realization brings about the transcending of heaven and hell, whilst in the very midst of heaven and hell continuously. Therein we are men and women. We are human beings. And this is something which has to be done and can be done by each one of us individually from within our own selves. And this is the real meaning of the theistic expression, devoting your life to the service of God.